some of the initial screens of applications and an initial interview. I'm responsible for planning a 3-day orientation before school begins. I'm responsible for observing teachers in the classroom. I'm responsible for seeing that our teachers receive some training during the school year and for evaluating their work. And as I said, for the past 10 years, these have been some of the responsibilities that I've had in my job at Logos. The author of this book is a man named John Milton Gregory. And he originally wrote this book for use by Sunday school teachers, which to me is even more impressive in a way. I would love to know the joy of having children attend Sunday school that is run by adults who've been trained according to the 7 laws of teaching. That would be a marvelous standard to see. But this book, The 7 Laws of Teaching, it's the most valuable and the best book that I know of to help teachers learn how to teach effectively. Any teacher, elementary or secondary age, who will study and comply with the teaching principles in this book has significantly increased their chances of being a successful teacher. Well, who is John Milton Gregory? He certainly had the credentials needed to legitimately write a book about effective teaching. He started working as a teacher at the ripe old age of 17. At age 30, he became the head of a classical school. 8 years later, he took over as the state superintendent of public instruction. Later, he was the president of Kalamazoo College. And finally, at the age of 48, he organized the college that later became the University of Illinois. Like Thomas Jefferson at the University of Virginia, Gregory felt that the 13 years he spent in support of establishing that institution, the University of Illinois, were the most important years of his life. John Milton Gregory's book is about the laws of teaching. Many of you are familiar with Dorothy Sayers. Dorothy Sayers wrote about the tools of learning. I presume that many of you are familiar with both those terms. I thought it might be good just to clarify the difference between the two as we begin our study this morning. What are the laws of teaching? The laws of teaching are the principles that are always present in the art of teaching. The laws of teaching are the principles that are always present in the art of teaching. Gregory wrote, "The 7 laws of teaching are natural laws, as fixed as the laws of planets or of growing organisms. It is a process in which definite forces are employed to produce definite results. And these results follow as regularly and certainly as the day follows the sun. Causation is as certain, if not always so obvious, nor easily understood, in the movements of the mind as those of matter. These laws of mind are as fixed as material laws." Gregory states that these laws are inherent. They are inescapable whenever teaching is present. He also states that the laws are not always obvious, nor are they easily understood, revealing the need for personal study of these laws. And he indicates in the book how he came upon deriving these 7 laws, and he indicates that it was done simply through careful observation of hours and hours and hours of teaching. And he implies that he watched both good teaching and bad teaching, because in each chapter, he not only has the law stated as rules to follow, he'll state the law and then he'll state the rule. If you want to comply with the law, these are the things you must do. But he also has many mistakes and how to violate each law of teaching in each chapter. So he learned not only, it seems, from the examples of good teachers, but from poor teachers as well. The author's purpose in this book is to set forth in a systematic order the principles of the art of teaching. He also makes it clear that he doesn't claim to set forth the whole art of teaching. He implies that these are the seven most important laws. They don't cover everything, but they cover the most important things. He said they're the leading principles and rules of the teaching art, allowing them to be methodically learned and used. It's worth noting also that Gregory discusses teaching as an art, not a science. I think that's an important distinction, one that has implications for our study. What is a tool of learning? Tools of learning are skills to be taught to students. Tools of learning are skills to be taught to students. Throughout their educational experience, students should not only be given these skills, they should be regularly instructed in the proper use of these tools. Dorothy Sayers, in her essay, illustrated this idea or contrasting ideas of how you go about teaching children with the image of teaching a child how to play the piano. According to one theory of learning, a child would be taught how to play a particular piece of music by heart, just by imitating someone else, without being taught how to play the scales, or without being taught how to read music. Just teach them how to play one particular piece of music. Compare that to the child who wasn't taught a piece of music at the beginning, but was taught the scales and was taught how to read music. She would favor that approach. Those were tools of learning related to music. She had another example of a child being given paint and brushes and told to express themselves, be creative. Okay, no skills, no rules to follow. While the other student is taught first how to hold a brush, how to use a brush, how to work with colors. Contrasting ideas. Tools of learning associated with schools include reading and writing, logical thinking, rhetorical skills. Okay. Let's begin by briefly reading through the seven laws of teaching, and I think they're listed on a sheet in your notebook. I think they're at the end of the second page of the outline. Law number one, a teacher must be one who knows the lesson or truth or art to be taught. Law number two, a learner is one who attends with interest to the lesson. Law three, the language used as a medium between teacher and learner must be common to both. 4. The lesson to be mastered must be explicable in the terms of the truth already known by the learner. The unknown must be explained by means of the known. Law 5. Teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind to grasp the desired thought or to master the desired art. 6. Learning is thinking into one's own understanding a new idea or truth, or working into habit a new art or skill. Law 7. The test and proof of teaching done, the finishing and fastening process, must be a reviewing, rethinking, re-knowing, reproducing, and applying of the material that has been taught, the knowledge and ideals and arts that have been communicated. What I'd like to do as I walk you through these today is I plan not to take them in order, but I imagine myself in a situation that I've been, and oftentimes before I've taken my new teachers through the first seven, through the lessons in the order that Gregory presents them in his book. One of the things that we typically do at Logos School with first-year teachers is during the first nine-week quarter of the school year, we have them read through the seven laws of teaching, and we have some lessons that go along with each law. But we want them to go through this book in that beginning quarter of the year and help them to get off to the right foot. So what I've done in my talk today is imagine that I'm in the process of working with a new teacher, and I want to walk through the implication of some of the laws as they think about teaching for the first time and consider the implication of each one. I want to go through these and imagine that we're dealing with someone who's finished their college degree or finished their own study, but they're in the position of preparing to teach for the first time. And as I'll amplify later, I don't believe that this book just applies to beginning teachers, but I want to take that approach today. I want to start by discussing the fifth law of teaching, not the first, the fifth. This law defines and describes what a teacher does. I would ask the novice to think about these questions. What is a teacher? A better question, what is the proper role of the teacher? What does a good teacher do? What is their function? And let them think for a few minutes about that. Because what I want to do as a result of talking about this law, I want to create an image in their mind of what the right thing to do is in that classroom. I want them to truly understand what their proper role is as a teacher. How will most young teachers answer this question? In my experience, most of the young teachers will think about a college instructor that they recently studied under, and they will consider that example, someone whom they may admire as a good teacher, but their answer will be patterned after however that college instructor taught. That might be a good thing, might be, but in my experience, college teaching is a poor example for high school teachers. And I work with secondary teachers. And I think if that's true at the secondary level, it's even more true at the elementary level. Maybe elementary teachers don't think that way as much. One of the differences in my mind, in college, students have much greater amount of accountability for learning on their own. My college classes, it was typical for the instructor to assign a large number of pages of reading that was rarely, if ever, discussed in class. Because the things that were discussed in class were separate. You were expected to comprehend the reading on your own. Okay. Not a good example for high school. What is the proper role of the teacher? The fifth law states, teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind to grasp the desired thought or to master the desired art. In this chapter, Gregory says, the actual work of the teacher consists of the awakening and setting into action the mind of the pupil. The work of the teacher is awakening and setting into action the mind of the pupil, the arousing of his self activities. He restates the rule this way, excite and direct the self activities of the pupil. And as a rule, tell him nothing that he can learn for himself. Tell him nothing he can learn for himself. This raises these questions. How do teachers awaken a student's mind? How do teachers set into action the mind of a pupil? How do teachers arouse student self-activity? Once awakened, how should teachers direct the self-activities of the students? How do you go about doing that? Gregory says to start the lesson when it is assigned by asking some question or by giving some statement that will awaken inquiry. You want to present something before your students, some problem to be solved. You want to create in them some motivation to learn the material that you want to present or have them study in class that day. So when you start a lesson, you need to start by trying to phrase a question that'll get their mind thinking. That's fulfilling your proper role. You're trying to awaken their own sense of inquiry. There are significant implications to this description of the proper role as the teacher. These descriptions imply that a teacher should do more questioning than telling. More questioning than telling. Teachers have to create interest in the lesson, then they have to direct the student's pursuit of understanding. New teachers, again, especially secondary teachers, often seem tempted to lecture to students. Often they will write lots of notes on the board, intending that the students copy everything written on the board. Is this the proper role of the teacher? Well, I'm not convinced that it is. There may be a time and a place to lecture. And what I tell my teachers who want to lecture is, if you can demonstrate to me that through the lecture method you can maintain the interest of the students, then I'll look for that and see if you're successful in achieving that. But it's not my preferred method. It's not the method I prefer that my teachers use on a regular basis. I think it's a pale imitation of the work that the teacher ought to do. The true function of the teacher is to create the most favorable conditions of self-learning for the student. Now that goes to the whole classroom environment as well, because once you set their minds to inquiry and they're ready to learn, you have to have an environment that's conducive to study. Gregory says that he teaches best who teaches least, or that he teaches best whose pupils learn most without being directly taught. Sometimes, when it's time to go observe a teacher and I'll schedule an observation for a particular day, the teachers want to pick a day when they are going to be up in front of the class doing something active. And I understand that motivation. In part, I don't want to come in and observe the students taking a test. Well, there's a good reason. But think about this law for a second. And if this law is true and understood both by the teacher and by the person coming in to observe, I don't need to see them lecturing to be able to evaluate the effectiveness of their teaching, if we accept this definition as true. In theory, I could evaluate their teaching not by watching them, but by watching the students. In fact, the teacher could even be sitting at their desk in a room of students who are well controlled, who are diligently working on the solution to some problem, and they might have done an outstanding job of teaching. Because maybe they've already raised that spirit of inquiry in the students, and the students are diligently working at it. That's what effective teaching might look like on a particular day. Okay. Now, more than sitting at their desk, I trust that the teacher's working with the students, making sure they're directed and staying on their course, and they're helping them through obstacles. I think that Gregory was also familiar with the need to reshape the notions of his young teachers. I don't think this is a new phenomenon. He said, the sooner the teacher abandons the notion that he can make his pupils intelligent by hard work upon their passive receptivity, the sooner he will become a good teacher and obtain the art, as Socrates said, of assisting the mind to shape and put forth its own conceptions. He didn't favor hard work upon students' passive receptivity. Sometimes, in fact, teachers violate this law by assuming they can force thinking by vigorous telling. Okay. Gregory also says that it is the unskilled teacher who prefers to hear his own voice in endless talk rather than watch and direct the course of the thoughts of his pupils. Okay. It's the unskilled teacher who prefers to hear his own voice. How do we know? We're a teacher. We accept this definition. We want to excite our students. We want to get them interested in the study that we have to present. How can we tell if we've properly excited the student's mind? What are the clues? Gregory says that teachers will know they have done so if students are asking questions. When each child in the room is asking questions, then we know that their mind is active and that they are interested in the lesson. Now that might be an ideal. Each child in the room asking questions. Good idea to shoot for. Rarely achieved, it seems. It's hard to get 100%. But that shouldn't discourage us from trying. Okay? What we're looking for as we stand in the front of the room is how many of the students are interested enough in turning the information over in their own head to ask us a question. And he also gives very practical advice about questioning, again, toward new teachers. Sometimes teachers, when they ask questions, are impatient. They're in such a hurry to get through the material, they'll ask a question, pause, no hands, Then give the kids the answer themselves 2 seconds later, okay, because they're impatient. Young teachers have to get comfortable with some silence in the room for a few moments and create an expectation in the classroom that the kids are expected to be attentive and thinking and willing certainly to call on students to answer and require that students give a good answer to the question. In my classroom, based on some examples that I saw, some teachers that I observed, if I call upon a student in a class and they give me an "I don't know" response, we don't move on. Okay, I don't want them to get comfortable saying "I don't know" and I'm off the hook and expect that I'll go to the next student. Now you try to be discerning. I don't want to really upset a student who truly doesn't know. They're thinking with me and they really just don't know. But I much prefer and try to create an environment where they know you give me your best shot. You get us started down the road to the correct answer, and then we'll move on to another student and see if they can add to that. But I want an environment where the kids know if I call on you, they're expected to give an answer. Another thing that I think is really helpful in regards to questioning is that you require your students to state an answer in a complete sentence. We ask them to write this way. I think it's good to ask them to respond this way verbally. I think it helps clarify their thinking. What we want then is for a teacher to begin their consideration of the lesson planning with these traits of the teacher in mind. I don't want the teacher to spend their time their first year writing out their lectures, okay, and then transferring all those things on the board. I want them to begin their lesson planning by understanding what their proper role is. If the teachers do that, if they prepare all those lecture notes, they're going to have a tremendous year of learning themselves. Okay? They're going to learn a tremendous amount of information. Okay? But the kids may not learn as much, and they won't understand why, perhaps. They want to excite the interest of their students. Elementary teachers, it might be a bit different. Maybe what you want is to keep from quashing the excitement of the students. My youngest son just finished his year in kindergarten. I remember Sunday night being in his room and telling him tomorrow was President's Day and he didn't have to go to school. But I want to go to school, Dad. I like school. I don't want a day off. He came to school with a natural excitement already. Okay, so sometimes our job is just to keep that excitement going. Elementary teachers want to keep them excited about learning. So we know we've attracted students' interest, or we've captured students' interest when they ask lots and lots of questions. That's our first goal. Now I want to pick another law. That one's a more big picture kind of question, but now I want to jump to the seventh law. It troubles me that it's so important in his list, and it's last. But sometimes you read the book through chronologically, especially when you're new, and the weight of what a good teacher looks like starts to weigh upon your shoulders a little bit, and you're ready to cry uncle by the time you get to the last chapter, because I've already learned 16 things that I'm not doing as well as I would like to. Okay, and that's one of the things for you administrators. As you work with teachers, if they have that propensity to be perfect right now, be patient, encourage them. Pick one or two areas to work on for a time. Pick one or two areas that you're going to work on for a few weeks. Let's get a handle on those, and we'll be patient, and we'll work on those others down the line. Okay, but now let's fix in our novice teacher's mind a commitment to regular classroom review. Regular classroom review. Many of you are familiar with what was once, just a few years ago, a revolutionary new math textbook series, the Saxon Math Series. What is the chief characteristic that at the time it was written distinguished it from all the other math texts that were available on the market? They all have math problems in them. Okay. John Saxon wrote a series of math books that had built in a regular, planned, periodic review of the concepts taught to the students. Every other math textbook taught students concepts, had a unit test, and dropped that idea or that topic for the remainder of the year. John Saxon wrote a series of math textbooks that once a concept was learned, students were held accountable to it for the remaining parts of the year. There would be questions on that topic that would pop up in the lessons throughout the rest of the year. Look how many textbooks he sold just building on that idea of regular review. People are willing to pay a high price to ensure that students had to review math concepts over and over. The seventh law of teaching states, the test and proof of teaching done, the finishing and fastening process, must be a reviewing, rethinking, renewing, reproducing, and applying of the material that has been taught, the knowledge and ideals and arts that have been communicated. How important is time spent in review? He writes, no time in teaching is spent more profitably than that spent in reviewing. No time in teaching. I want our young teacher to plan, to commit to planning and conducting regular reviews. If we commit before the year begins to regular reviews, we will better be prepared to fight that urgent feeling that we have, especially in the spring, of teaching more content. Which is more important? To squeeze in time at the end of the year to teach one more new idea, or to stop presenting new material and to review lessons that have already been taught? You know the feeling that comes in April or May when you realize you've gotten behind in your teaching. The number of days that you have left in your school year doesn't match the number of items left on your list that you really wanted to teach. Okay, you've gotten behind. Well, what do we do now? Well, we'll just press a little harder on that gas pedal. I'm still going to teach them all. I'm going to go a little bit quicker, move through the material a little bit faster than normal, and I can still cover all that material I'd hope to cover at the beginning of the year. That's why I think we need to make commitment to regular review before we get into that situation. In the clarity of the summer months, commit yourself, commit your young teachers to making time for review. What does that mean? That means there will be some things that you won't be able to teach. That's exactly what that means. You're going to have to shorten the list of objectives that you would like to teach. Or you can simply assign more homework. I'm just kidding. You can't do that. Okay? Don't do that to your kids. Okay? That's been one solution I've seen teachers try to use. Okay? Review needs a time lag, he says. Review needs a time lag. But it doesn't have to be long. He talks about different kinds of review that teachers should plan. He says we should review daily. This spring, I had the pleasure of going to an ACCS school in Northern Virginia and observing for a day in the secondary classrooms. And I knew, I think by the time I had sat through the third class session, I knew that those teachers had been well trained in the seven laws of teaching. I was certain of it. And the reason that I knew it is because every class that I sat in, the teacher started each period by reviewing the information that had been taught the previous day. And I began to think at first, I thought, well, that's really good. I wonder if that's coincidence. And by the third hour, I knew, no, this is an entire staff that is teaching this way. It was well done. How do we review daily? Just call upon a student and ask them to go over to the highlights of the lesson from the previous day. It's another good way of holding them accountable. Sometimes you could put up a few questions on the board. Gregory tells us that the use of handwork in review ought by no means to be neglected. Okay, if we call upon a student, then we know they have the interest of one student in the class. But if sometimes we put up questions on the board and ask the students to write out the answers to those questions, then I can ensure that I've got the minds of all of the students in my classroom thinking about the topic, reviewing the material. And then go over those answers orally. You don't even need to grade them every day. But review daily. That's the principle. Review weekly. A number of my staff members like to give weekly quizzes for just this purpose, that ensuring that kids do some regular review. For most of these teachers, the quizzes will be cumulative over the course of the semester. One thing to be careful is that all the quizzes don't fall on Friday. Okay, three or four quizzes in a day can be tough on your students. They get a steady diet of that. But review weekly. Take a little bit broader look. we review at the end of the semester. The main reason why we give semester exams at Logos School is to ensure that we will have some review at the end of the semester. We have a guideline for our staff that before that final exam, that teachers are required to spend at least 3 class periods reviewing the most important information that was taught that semester, and that 3 days is a minimum. 3 days of review. Stop teaching new information. Look back over that first semester. What were the most important things that you taught the kids that semester? What are the things that you want to have the best chance of having them hang on to those things in the coming months and in the coming years? Some of my teachers will say, everything. Every objective that I taught. Okay? But try to prioritize those. What are the essential things? Note also that in the definition, a good review is much more than a repetition. And I'm not against repetitions, but we shouldn't settle for that 100% of the time. Okay? A good review goes back over the same information, but asks the student to consider the information from a different perspective. Gregory uses an illustration of a diamond. He says if the diamond represents the topic or the idea that you taught, you want to rotate that diamond. You want to look at it through a little bit different angle and a different perspective. Okay, you want to ask yourself as a teacher, how can I repackage that information and to ask the kids to look at it from a different perspective? Maybe that's by applying it in a new situation. That type of review takes some planning and it takes some thought. Consider, too, in this chapter on review, Gregory's definition for what student learning is. He defines for us when we can say that a student has learned. Not what a pupil has once learned and recited, but what he permanently remembers and uses is the correct measure of his achievement. What he permanently remembers and uses. Hey, this would be a good start. We have a teacher who knows and understands their proper role, and we have a teacher who's committed to regular review. What's next? Okay, we've considered what a teacher is. Let's turn our attention to what a student is. What is a student? A student is a physical being who has a pulse, is conscious, and is present in the same room as one who teaches. Okay? You know some of those students. Okay? They're in your classrooms. That's not good. What are the essential characteristics of a student? Okay. Of course, it has to do with the condition of their mind. A student is one who learns. To say that one has learned, Gregory says that the pupil must reproduce in his own mind the truth to be learned. Okay. The problem here is that students don't come equipped with their own data ports. Okay, just think, we could simply connect a cable from the brain of the teacher to the brain of the students, push copy and paste, press a button, whap, what a time saver. Okay, we just download that information. Okay, but our author defines teaching as an art. It's not a science, not a mechanical process. What we would gain in the time we would save by the mechanical transfer of information, sure, we'd pay a price for that. What we would lose, our students' ability to understand things or perceive things that we haven't taught them, to make new associations. And he said there are different levels of learning. Listen to the completion of this sentence. These describe different levels of learning. A student has learned when it is committed to memory and may be recited word for word. When it is committed to memory and may be recited word for word. Catechism approach. Again, that's not bad. There are times when that type of learning is appropriate. Next is a higher level of learning. Memorization with comprehension of the work memorized. Memorization with comprehension of the work memorized. The third level. Students can translate the concept into their own words without detriment to the meaning. Students can translate the concept into their own words without detriment to the meaning. Fourth, the student begins to seek evidence of the statement which he studies. The real student seeks proofs. The antithesis of this is the student who's been subtly taught that everything in the textbook is true. Okay, how do we know that's true? Well, it's written there, right in my textbook. Okay, well, that's not a sacred work. The highest level of learning is when the student finds a use in everyday life for the knowledge he has gained. Students find a use in everyday life for the knowledge he has gained. Keep in mind that the author's original audience was Sunday school teachers. Okay. This stage would be difficult to apply to all the fields of knowledge in the school, but I think it's still a good definition for the type of learning that we should shoot for. These are the characteristics that we will look for in our students. We learned earlier that interest is revealed by questioning. We also know now, for example, that when a student can restate a concept in their own words, that they have achieved learning at a more basic level. Your classroom teacher should ask the kids to do this on a regular basis. It can be in discussion, in an oral interchange, it can be in writing. Take this concept that I've given to you and restate it to me in your own words. And if they can do so and still have expressed the same meaning, then they've learned well. Sometimes, again, the tyranny or the urgency of getting through material so we can get on to the next section sometimes makes it hard for us to get to these higher level of learning. Okay, we're in too much of a hurry. We need to slow down and make sure we have understanding before we proceed. Okay, our novice teacher has learned their proper role. He will diligently plan for regular review. He also has in his mind now the level of learning that he will seek to achieve in his students. Okay, let's move now from kind of the big picture of what a teacher and what a student is to some particular instruction that gives some additional specific descriptions to his task. This kind of moves into the very practical aspects of teaching. Okay, at some point, someone needs to tell the novice teacher something that he maybe hasn't learned yet, but is about to find out, and that is that good teaching involves many, many hours of hard work. Okay, the first law of teaching states a teacher must be one who knows the lesson or truth or art to be taught. How well do we really know something when we graduate from college? Probably not well. Not as well as we think we do. That probably depends on how our college instructors taught us or how we studied when we were in college. But oftentimes we're allowed in college to learn the material for the exam and then to forget it. Okay. Many, many new teachers quickly discover the difference between being familiar with something and really knowing something. Okay. You find out how well you know something as soon as you try to teach it to someone else. Okay, there's some real clarity. Might as well tell young teachers that they're going to go through that. Okay, we used to have a saying for that at Logos. We called it FITS, first-year teacher syndrome. Okay, some of those things that there's no other way to get through other than just experience it 1 year, but know that you're not alone. Other people have gone through the same thing, and it will get better. You also find out how well you know something if you try and stand before a class and answer the questions that the lessons provoked. Okay, that can be a humbling experience. You've taught something well, and they ask you 3 questions in a row that you don't know the answer to. Okay. If some of you here are preparing for the first time, you just need to know it's hard work. And I would wonder, especially for secondary teachers, how many different preps you have. For secondary teachers, I think that 4 is about the limit. 4 different classes that you're going to have to prepare for to teach daily. Maybe more if we're talking about math or foreign language, because the lessons more are laid out for themselves. Elementary teachers, hopefully you have someone to come in to teach some of the different subjects during the day, PE, art, music, maybe Latin. You have a lot to handle. I wonder, in fact, if there's any teacher in the school who has greater general knowledge than the sixth grade teacher. I admire sixth grade teachers. They have to know a lot about a lot of different subjects at a pretty high level. Good teachers must work hard to learn the information that they will teach, even if during the first year that means you're only staying a week ahead of the students. Okay, you wouldn't be the first in that situation. And if you're in that situation, resolve to do the best you can the first year and to be better the second year. It's not a fun feeling to know that you're not doing as well as you ought to be doing. Just don't stay there for a long time. Okay, do the best you can. How do we know when we've really learned? Boy, when we can easily answer questions from our students. That becomes a fun feeling. When we have the power to readily explain and prove the idea asserted. When we can think of illustrations to help our students gain that understanding that we want them to gain. That comes out of clear and familiar knowledge. When we have learned our lessons well, we're no longer subservient to the textbooks. You can see teachers gain the confidence that says, I'm not going to teach chapters 1 through 5 in order anymore. I'm going to teach it this way for this reason, because they're comfortable with the textbook. There's nothing wrong with starting and using that textbook as kind of your skeletal structure to your course. But you can tell as teachers, the more knowledge they gain, they begin to move away from the dependence on the text. We are confident when we learn our material in selecting the right materials. We can do some curriculum review and figure out this book is better than that. Teaching is a lot more fun. Experienced teachers, there's a caution in this first law for you as well. You must be committed to preparing each lesson with fresh study. The organized among you will be tempted to pull last year's lesson out of the drawer and teach it again without reviewing it. Okay, shame on you. Don't get sloppy. Take the lesson and revise it. See if you can make it better, or see if you can add something new to the lesson. That's difficult to do with each and every lesson that you teach. But don't make a pattern of teaching the same lessons over and over. If you do, you'll become the teacher who taught 1 year 12 times rather than the teacher who has 12 years of teaching experience. Okay? Also, in regard to teaching, a couple other practical applications are in this chapter. What do you do when the student asks you that question that you don't know the answer to? Just be honest. I don't know the answer to that question. I'll have to try and find out tonight and tell you tomorrow. Don't let your young teachers especially try to bluff the kids. They're too discerning. They've been in a classroom for too long. They know when a teacher is trying to pull the wool over their eyes, and that can cause a loss of respect. Just be honest, especially if you're young. There's nothing wrong with telling them you don't know. Okay. Also, if you have young teachers who are having problems in controlling their classroom, Gregory gives us a hint as to one of the causes. He says, good teaching will bring about good order. When you have the kids interested in the lesson and what they're studying, they behave better because they're focused on what you want them to do. What have we learned? We have our teacher who can describe the kind of learning that will lead him to say his student has learned. And now he knows that his profession obligates him to hard work. Gregory's laws include some ideas that will make his hard work efficient and profitable. Next, let's carefully consider the language that our teacher uses. His language includes the words that he speaks in class and the words that he writes on assignment and test. Common sense informs us that we should use language that is understood by our students. The rule states, the language used as a medium between teacher and learner must be common to both. Think of a Venn diagram, a picture of two intersecting circles. One circle represents the vocabulary used and understood by the teacher. The other circle, the vocabulary used and understood by the student. As teachers, we have to pick the language that's in the intersecting circles. Okay, we have to communicate in language that's understood by our students. Now, that doesn't mean that at times we can't pick language that we know but the kids don't know and use it, but just be aware when you're doing it so you can explain the meaning to the students. And your language won't be a hindrance, but it'll be a help to them. How do you learn the language that the students know? Have them read out loud to you. Pick sections of your textbook. Even if you don't need to have that textbook read out loud, it's a good idea for teachers to listen to kids read. They'll come to vocabulary words that they can't pronounce, and part of the reason they can't pronounce them is they don't know the meaning of those words. And that will begin to help you be aware of what their vocabulary level is. Okay, so your language can be a help, not a hindrance. Another hint in this chapter is, what do you do when a student asks you a question and you've given them an answer to the question and they still don't understand you? Gregory says one of the tricks of the trade is ask one of the other students in the class to try to answer that student's question. In part, they may be able to give understanding because the vocabulary of the student is similar to the vocabulary of the one asking the question. Good teachers also never presume that students comprehend what they're saying. How often do you ask your class, does everyone understand? And no one raises their hand. And you give the test, and you find out not everybody understood. Don't assume that that answer is true. Okay? Go ahead, ask the students, push. Well, if everyone understands, then you ought to be able to answer this question. And then ask Johnny to answer your question. You might be surprised. You probably won't be surprised to find out they don't know as much as they think they do. Lastly, related to language and understanding, don't wait until the test to find out how much the students comprehend. The test should not be the first time that you check for comprehension. By the time you give them that test, you ought to have a good expectation that they're ready for it and that they're going to do well. And how do you know that? Because you've already asked them in class informally. It's not the first time. Okay. The next law refers to the capabilities of students and how they learn. The lesson to be mastered must be explicable in the terms of the truth already known by the learner. The unknown must be explained by the known. Carefully note the inclusion of the word must in this law. The unknown must be explained by the known. There is no other alternative. If we're going to begin the proper instruction at the proper place, what do we have to know? We have to know what the kids already come to class with. We have to communicate with them. We have to listen to them. We have to read their written work. So one of the first things we have to do is figure out, what do they know? Have you ever taught a lesson on something that you thought was new and you found out because one of the kids told you that they'd had a similar lesson the previous year? Okay. And you have to adjust your expectations. We have to know what the students comprehend so we can carefully begin planning each lesson. Lessons that are carefully planned are like a series of steps that are built at their proper rise and run. Okay, they match a person's natural gait. They're easy to walk up. If you ever walked up a set of steps that were either too wide and the rise was too short, and you couldn't easily walk up them, and you had to think about where your feet were going instead of just walking up and watching. Lessons that are carefully planned are like those carefully built steps. They help the learning process. We should relate new lessons to old lessons. We build steps that way. We also should understand that we can't force understanding by talking slowly. And we can't force understanding by talking urgently. Okay, we have to construct right. What do we have now? We have carefully chosen vocabulary, carefully planned lessons. Our final law has some of the most helpful advice in all of Gregory's book. Teaching is arousing and using the pupil's mind to grasp the desired thought or to master the desired art. If students are to learn their lessons, the first thing that we have to have is their attention. One application of this, known to experienced teachers, is never to begin teaching until you have the attention of all of the students in your classroom. Don't ever start until you have all eyes on you. This starts from the moment class begins. It continues throughout the lesson. Good teachers never talk over the conversation of their students. You have to have the students' interest. But the patient observer, the careful observer, and Gregory was one of those, noted there are three different types of attention, and he defines all three. He says the first kind of attention is passive attention. You might call it daydreaming. Okay, it's really no control of the will. I'm just going to pay attention to whatever is most interesting to me at the moment. It might be out the window, might be something on the wall, might be something the student next to me is doing. That's just daydreaming. It's just passive attention. Okay, I'm paying attention to whatever is most pleasurable. He said there's a better level of attention, that's controlled attention. That's when you have a teacher who's a good disciplinarian and can insist that the students sit up straight in their desks and their eyes are to the front and they're quiet and they're still. They're paying attention because they're required to. That's better than the first, but it's not good enough. They might not like to find the lesson appealing, but they'll pay attention to the lesson because they're required to. The third type of attention is what we want, and he calls it secondary passive attention. We want kids to be attentive because they find the lesson interesting. Even more than we want that because they're required to pay attention to the lesson. How do we do that? Well, he gives us an approach. It's very useful for creating interest. It's called the problem approach. If I were teaching Northwest history and I was going to use the problem approach, I would focus on decisions. I might talk to my kids about the time Lewis and Clark came. They're following the Missouri River to its source. That's what Jefferson told them to do. The Indians had given them advice. Here's what you're going to find. Here's how to follow the course of the Missouri. But they get out and they come to a place where there's a fork. And the Indians hadn't told them about this fork. And they didn't know which way was the right way. And if they took the wrong way, they weren't going to get over the Rocky Mountains in time. And you set up that situation to the students using the problem approach, and then you stop. Students, I'm going to turn this over to you now. You're Lewis and Clark. You figure out what to do. And you've got all these men who are relying on you, by the way. And they, all to a man, think you're wrong. Okay? They think it's the other way. And you just leave it there with the problem approach before you tell them how it was resolved. Okay? That approach, it's not useful for teaching all the time. It has its place in creating interest in the lesson and gathering their attention. Okay? Success in learning requires effort, sacrifice, and persistence. Problem approach isn't something the teacher will rely on every day. Okay, a few closing comments about these laws. I think these laws are applicable to elementary and secondary teachers. I think the applications would be different, but I think each group would find the laws valuable. According to Gregory, all teaching contains within it these laws. They are unavoidable. Next, I would commend the study of these laws to all the teachers on your staff. I've used examples of beginning teachers, but I think they're also valuable for veteran teachers. I have, without apology, required my experienced staff to go back and read the seven laws for a second time. I have no problem doing that. This is the kind of book that bears reading and rereading. There isn't a teacher who would find the study of this work to be a waste of time. And it's short, it's concise, and it's full of practical knowledge. I believe all teachers should be required to study the seven laws. I think it should be a foundation for other types of staff training. Other topics that would follow it would be the Christian philosophy of education and the tools of learning for the grammar stage, dialectic stage, and poetic stage. The seven laws of teaching won't ensure that your teachers are teaching classically. It just is a good place to start because they'll be teaching effectively. Okay. I also think it's a good idea, another good topic is just to evaluate how you're integrating subjects. A few limitations. I just mentioned one. It doesn't ensure distinctly classical teaching. I've mentioned to you the value in preparing young teachers. And I would appeal you to read it, reread it, seek to apply it. Closing, I want to leave you with Gregory's vision for the proper role of the teacher. It is the teacher's mission to stand at the spiritual gateways of his pupil's mind, serving as a herald of science, a guide through nature, to summon the minds to their work, to place before them the facts to be observed and studied, and to guide them into the right paths to be followed. It is his by sympathy, by example, and by every means of influence, by objects for the senses, by facts for the intelligence, to excite the mind of the pupil, to stimulate their thoughts. As we work toward these high levels of understanding, keep in mind that what we want is to have our students be independent searchers in the fields of knowledge, not passive learners at the hands of others. Thank you.